Welcome to the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Listen and grow as Del questions the status quo, encourages you to think differently, and empowers you to make a better life. Get ready as Del challenges core beliefs, seeks the truth, and reveals the roadmap to the lifestyle you really want. And now your host, multi-millionaire, national award-winning investor, CEO and founder of Lifestyles Unlimited, Del Walmsley.
Welcome to Del Walmsley Radio Show, where the hype ends and the help begins. I'm your host, Del Walmsley, and as always, we're working on your financial freedom. Today, we are going to the mailbag, and I've got some interesting emails here that we want to share with you and answer some questions for you. By the way, if you have questions you'd like answered, you can contact me at Ask Del, and that's A-S-K-D-E-L, Ask Del at L-U-I-N-C.com. When you send me your emails, I'll answer some of them by email. Some of them I think are interesting enough to bring on the radio, and we'll answer them on the radio. Otherwise, definitely want to get your questions answered. So today, we're going to start with the question that I get all the time, and that is, what is the 4% drawdown rule? And so I thought I'd look it up just to be able to give you a very informed, accurate answer to it with more details. And I quote, financial planner William Bengel invented the 4% rule in 1994 after publishing his research in the Journal of Financial Planning. The guideline is a type of retirement drawdown system meant to help retirees safely withdraw their savings. What is the 4% rule? Bengel created the 4% rule after running historical market data to determine a safe withdrawal rate for retirement savings. This system operates on three primary principles. Number one, initial withdrawal rate. In your first year of retirement, you can withdraw 4% of your total retirement savings. For example, if you have $1 million in savings, you would withdraw $40,000. Now let's think about that logically. If all you have is $100,000, all you could withdraw would be $4,000, right? So there's one limitation. If you don't have a lot of money, this system doesn't work very well. Second, it says inflation adjustments. Each subsequent year, you adjust your withdrawal amount to account for inflation, ensuring your purchasing power is maintained. So the concept sounds good, that here's this lump sum of money. You're going to pull down 4% of it the first year. And then each year after that, you're going to look at inflation. If inflation has gone up, then this amount that you would have pulled down has to go up also for you to be able to maintain your standard of living. But what if the financial lump of sum of money didn't go up? What if it didn't inflate? What if the stock market went down that year or bond market didn't do well that year? Whatever it is, because he's based on stocks and bonds. Next, asset allocation. The rule assumes a balanced investment portfolio, typically consisting of 50 to 75% stocks and the remainder bonds. So the idea is the bonds will produce some distributions every year that hopefully, and this is the hopeful part to it, is that the bonds will produce enough distribution that it'll pay the 4% without digging into the stocks if the stocks happen to go down that year. Makes a lot of sense on the surface. It's been used and touted and memorialized by thousands of financial planners for years now. How has the rule evolved? Well, let's take a look here. It says on this other question, because I asked him, does it still work? It was the next question I asked AI, and it said, the 4% drawdown system is no longer considered a bulletproof, set it and forget it strategy for retirement, but rather a flexible guideline. While it worked consistently based on historical data, experts now recommend a more dynamic approach to approach that considers today's market conditions and longer life expectancies and personal needs. Why the original 4% rule became outdated. Built on old data, 4% rule was developed in mid-1990s and is based on market data from 1926 to 1976. It was built to endure market cycles and inflation during the period, but today's financial environment is different. It assumes a 30-year retirement. The original rule was designed for 30-year retirement. However, people are living longer. And for many, a 30-year retirement time frame is no longer a sufficient planning horizon. Retiring early would also mean that the rule is not effective. Inflation has varied. The rule adjustment for inflation annually, but it cannot account for significant unexpected inflationary pressures that impact purchasing power. Like when inflation goes from 2% up to 12 or 13%. And the other real problem with this, I'm thinking about this, is that when he did this analysis, inflation was based on a broad range of things. What the government has done recently in the last 10 years is taken out all of the stuff that really inflates, right? Housing is taken out of the inflation adjustment anymore. The stuff that really goes up and really becomes expensive and costly, they've taken out because they wanted a lower inflation rate to make the, you know, each administration look better on paper. I don't see that, right? I just don't see that the numbers make sense anymore at all. Moving on, market volatility. The rule relies on historical market trends that are not guaranteed to repeat. Depending on your asset allocation and when you retire, market volatility could make 4% either way too aggressive or way too conservative. And it does not factor in taxes and fees. The original rule does not account for taxes or investment fees, which can significantly reduce what you have left over. Taxes of the past are not equal to taxes of the future. So in other words, they keep changing the tax laws, what you can and cannot write off and so on and so forth on these things, and what tax bracket you're in, and et cetera, et cetera. I tend to believe that the more that you have, the more money you have, the higher tax bracket you're going to be in, the more problematic this plan might be. It goes on and says, so what now? What's today's approach financial planners are using? Instead of a rigid 4% plan, modern retirement strategies use it as a starting point. Key adjustments include flexibility withdrawing rates. You may be able to withdraw a higher percentage in some years and need to take a smaller amount in others, especially during market downturns. Some recent studies suggest a high withdrawal rate may be safer under certain conditions. Just logically, and as I read this and I'm thinking, hey, you and I guys, we're real people out here. If your stock market made $100,000 this year, you can take $100,000. You still have what you had in it last year. If it loses money next year, you can't take anything out because it's down. You got to wait for it to go back up. The idea is if you took the $100,000 out, could you live on half of it so the next year you wouldn't have to worry? Could you start to build up some type of a buffer? That's the problem with all this. If you took the $100,000 out, then you don't have it making you more money. And the idea is it would make you more money. And what happens is, and what they believe to have happened or should happen, is something called dollar cost averaging. If you continue to buy stocks as you make money, year after year after year, month after month after month, the dollar cost averaging effect, the fact that sometimes you're paying more for stock and sometimes you're paying less for stock, averages out to give you an average stock price that makes this system work, right? And they're saying, it doesn't work that way anymore. You know, stock market is very volatile, way more volatile than it used to be. If you think about it, you know, it used to fluctuate between 6,000 and 7,000. Now it's fluctuating between 30,000 and 40,000. Massive adjustments. It says what you should do is adjust for current conditions. Today's higher interest savings accounts may increase portfolio longevity. Conversely, a prolonged bear market could demand more cautious approach. Plan for higher expenses later in life. Lifetime expending curve is a modern approach that accounts for higher expenses early in retirement because of travel and other things you look to do, and potentially increasing medical costs later. Now, that's a new one that I never thought about, is that, hey, it could become more expensive the older you are as you try to, you know, work your way towards retirement, which makes that system even more dangerous, if you ask me. All right, let's move on. By the way, before we dig into this next email, I just want to remind you that tonight we have a case study in Houston, Texas. It'll be live in Houston, or you can watch it online if you'd like to watch it online. And then this weekend we have a two-day, October 4th and 5th, that you can come to. It's in Houston, Texas. We also have Honolulu coming up October 11th and 12th, and we have Richmond, Virginia coming up November 8th and 9th. So it's a lot of opportunities for you to get in here, get started, get the information you need so that maybe you can buy yourself a Christmas present and make some money. Wouldn't that be nice to actually make some money for the holidays instead of just spending all your money for the holidays? All right, next email. It says, hello, Dell. Some of my children are students at a university. Situated in a small town, the university is growing, which means its student housing is tight and getting tighter. Because of its size and general isolation from larger cities, there is one landlord who has a lock on the market. As you can guess, however, he has little to no competition. The rental houses that he has are terrible, and it's obvious that there's absolutely no investment in the maintenance or upkeep. In short, the bar is set very, very low in this environment. Modest but habitable rental housing should have a huge impact. The problem is the typical houses in this town were built between 1900 and 1940. I have not done any formal investigation of any of the properties, but you and I both know that these houses will have lead base, paint, and asbestos in them. My question is, do you think there would be still room for investment, or should I not even give it a try? I suspect that given the age and the historic lack of maintenance, any investment would be a complete knockdown and rebuild. All right, let's look at this, because my gut has two or three different reactions to it right away. All right. Number one reaction is I don't like student housing. All right. So let's just take that one and put that over here to the side. Why do you not like student housing? Have you ever met students? Of course, your kids, you love your kids. Your kids are different. Your kids are completely different than everybody else's kids in the whole world. But I was a kid once, and we lived in student housing, and it was a nightmare. Because kids are kids, right? They're just not your regular, calm, quiet tenants that take, you know, things slow and don't destroy your property. All right? But whatever. We'll throw that one out to the side. Well, no, we won't. We'll go back to it one more time. There was a member here that decided he wanted to do student housing, and he bought a bunch of apartment complexes in a student housing town. I told him not to do it, specifically told him don't do it. He said, well, I'm going to do it anyway. He did it, and he lost all of his investors' money, all of their money on all of the deals he bought. He's no longer with Lifestyles after that embarrassment, and it's quite obvious that I don't have a liking for student housing, and that was made it even worse when I saw that happen. All right, now let's go to the question. What about this situation economically where there's no competition? Well, that is a very good indicator that there might be some possibilities. And what you might look at in here is, number one, I would take one house. I'd go find the cheapest house I could find that fits the location needed for housing, student housing. And don't buy it. Analyze it. Take yourself over a general contract. Say, you know, go in to the broker or the realtor and say, hey, I would like to look at this at buying this thing. I'm going to bring in some people and do some inspections and find out, you know, what I'm really up against with this house. Bring your inspectors in, go through your due diligence and analyze what it would actually cost. Then what you do is you go back to the seller and say, okay, let's say, for instance, you got to pay $200,000 for this house. That's what they have it on the market for. You might go, well, I've just got all these reports right here that say that it's going to cost me $50,000 to renovate this place. You have asbestos, you have lead-based paint, whatever the, you know, he thinks is in there. And by the way, in some places, that's more of a problem than others, and you really need to know your area. He says he's in, I think, in the East Coast. I think he's not telling me where he's at. I will suggest to you that some cities, it's very, very problematic to have those things, almost where you might as well tear the building down. Other states, counties, cities, it's not as egregious of a problem. They'll let you mitigate it in certain ways. It doesn't cost as much money. So you need to research that also. So now that you research what you will have to do to be legal and you've researched what it would cost to do to get it done, now you can go back to the agents and offer them lowball offers. And I say lowball compared to what they're thinking they're going to get. They're thinking they're going to get $200,000. Well, you're going to figure out what the after repaired value is. If it's after repaired value $200,000, you're going to buy it not only at after repaired minus repairs, because you don't do the work for nothing. So typically the stuff we buy, if it would be $200,000 house, it's got $50,000 worth of repairs, we're going to buy it for $100,000 or $110,000. So that by the time we do the $50,000 repairs, we've still got $50,000 of captured equity the day we buy it, maybe more or maybe less. Let's just say it's got to be at least as much as what we put down. Now, you're going to have to use hard money lending, because you can't get lending on properties that don't qualify for Fannie Mae financing. So you're going to have to use a hard money lender. And when you use the hard money lender, they'll give you the money to buy it and they'll give you the money to renovate it. as long as the renovations don't go above 75% of the after repaired value. So at this point, I think you take a look at it, okay, just to see, because it might be a gold mine. Like you, the way you've outlined the situation might be a gold mine. Now I go to thought number three. And John, this is a fun one. I'm a type B personality, and what does type B personality not want to do is work. And if I can go out and buy something I know makes sense because I've got a model, I've been following the model, and I can repetitiously buy houses under my model over and over and over again. I've been doing it for 35 years with thousands of people. Why go try to reinvent the wheel? Why go try to make student housing work? Why go try to make, you know, 1900s houses when we're buying 2000, year 2000 houses, 18, you know, right now we're buying 1975 and newer, and you're looking at 1900s, you know, 75 years older than the stuff that we work with. Why work with stuff 75 years older? Why work with students when we don't have to work with students? Why go through all of these EPA problems when we don't have to? Bingo. There comes the third wheel of this discussion is, why would I do it? There's a funny joke I saw one time, and it makes me think of this kind of stuff whenever I see it. There was a big fat girl in a cartoon, and she had on a really tight little bikini. And the cartoon caption said, just because you can buy it doesn't mean you should wear it. In this situation, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. We'll take a break. Be right back with the Del Walmsley Radio Show.
Teaching you with a roadmap to creating the lifestyle you really want. Keep listening. The Del Walmsley Radio Show returns in moments.
Working full-time but still falling behind? Learn how real estate education can help you build income and get ahead. On your terms, text RADIO to 88007. That's RADIO to 88007. Presented by Lifestyles Unlimited.
You're hearing the Del Walmsley Radio Show. Want more life-changing knowledge? Access our podcast and listen on demand at lifestylesunlimited.com under the radio tab. Now your host, Del Walmsley.
Welcome back to Del Walmsley Radio Show. Today we're going to the mailbag for questions that you would send to us. And love answering your questions, so feel free to send me as many of them as you like to askdell@luinc.com. Also want to remind you that tonight we have a case study in Houston, Texas. You can come to it here live at the office, or you're welcome to watch it online. And then we have the 2-day this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the 4th and 5th of October. We also have the Honolulu 2-day coming up here in October. That's 11th and 12th, and David Fisher's flying out there to do the Honolulu. And then we have Richmond, Virginia, which is November 8th and 9th. So a lot of opportunities for you to get out there and get started with us. Let's go ahead and hit these emails again. Hey, Dell, I'm 52 years young and looking to find a way to start collecting some passive income streams. I enjoy my job, so I'm not looking to retire quickly, but would like to retire before the normal 67. The problem is I don't have a 401k or a house to leverage. I have roughly $5,000 saved, but I have a sub 500 credit score. Is there a way to start passively and work my way into some savings in order to buy some properties? I've enjoyed listening to you for the past few months, and hopefully you'll have some suggestions for me. Well, James, the problem is that if you had small amount of money, but you had great credit, we could go use hard money lenders to get you into deals with very little down. I mean, all the deals are available that way, but every once in a while we'll have a deal we could find with very little to nothing down. So you could work around that. But because you have bad credit, those hard money lenders are not going to be able to get your money back out, get you out of that and into another loan to get their money back. So they're not going to want to work with you. On the other hand, if you had money but no credit, we could work it, because we could use a different kind of loan to get you out of the hard money loan, a asset-based loan, and it would be based on equity. And so even though you don't have the money to put down, you could use your credit. And the way we did the deal to create the equity to be able to do the deal. So where does that place you? You're in a position with $5,000 where, number one, you need a rainy day fund. And if all you have is $5,000, I would definitely want to keep that around for my rainy day fund. I would build on it, though. And I would build up to where I could get, you know, at least $10,000 to $15,000 before you go buy your first rent house. And then, only then, if you could do it with hard money lending, I'd start working on my credit if that's possible. I know there are ways to increase your credit score. You really need to get it up over 600 to be able to use all the tools that we use. 700's really great, but at least 600 to be able to use these tools correctly. So unfortunately, this just isn't the right opportunity for you. Could be in the future. And I think sometimes it's good just to realize, hey, how far away am I? Well, I would say you need to save up another $10,000, then look back and we'll see what we can do for you. Okay? Moving on. The next email. I've been listening to radio show for a couple of years on the John Fredericks Network, which is out east, generally on my drive home from former job. Short story, I left my job this January to run and build my own business full-time. Okay? So that's a major situation here. He left his job. He's got his own full-time business. Last year, I inherited an IRA trading account from which to take required minimum distributions as calculated amounts in order to drain it in 10 years. Since I inherited and I'm only 52, I don't pay early withdrawal penalty, but I have to pay income tax on the money. All right. So if you don't understand what's going on here, he's just got an IRA. And what they were doing in the IRA is it owns stocks and he trades stocks every day. He's a day trader. It's what he's doing. It's all inside of an IRA. And you have to understand that he's kind of just likes to do this stuff. And or he's got a secondary situation. And as I listen to these things and I talk to people, the problem is that personalities come into play. And you can hear a little bit of it as we read through this, of the personality that comes through on this. And then I'm going to discuss it. And at the end, I'll answer the question. I just want to read the whole thing because the personalities, you might be one of these people that have these same issues. He goes on and says, my wife works and probably will continue, but here in Virginia, we can live quite comfortably in the 12% federal tax bracket. So why does he make that statement to me? We can live comfortably in the 12% tax bracket. Is he want to stay in the 12% tax bracket? You understand, staying in the 12% tax bracket means you're earning virtually nothing, right? Very little money. And the statement means something. People don't make statements that don't mean something. Why does he want to stay in the 12% tax bracket? Now, in later emails, he brought up stuff, really changed his approach to the conversation. But at that point, it really didn't mean anything because I'd already gotten this impression of where he was at, and it's answered and answered his question. So we'll go on and says, I'm managing the trading account myself and have been doing pretty good with this account so far, to the point that I'm earning more than I'm required to take out right now. Well, there it is. He's excited about it. He's having fun playing with this trading account. He's feeling good about himself with this trading account, okay? So I just want you to get that realization that this, you know, this email could simply be to tell me how great he's doing and want to share that with me, that he's doing well at this and he feels proud of himself, feels good about himself, okay? He's earning more than he has to take out. He's got required minimum distribution rule. Says he has to get rid of all this money out of this account within 10 years is what he's saying. If this continues, my required minimum distributions will jump up from the 12% to the 24% tax bracket very soon. With last year's and this year's distributions, it's still hanging in around $560,000. That's the account. And more than half of it is currently sitting in cash, waiting for the next good buying opportunity or to be pulled out for a better investment. So there it is. He's got a large chunk of money he's playing with. He's trading. And he's enjoying it. So, okay, that's good. That's what he wants to do. I don't see anything wrong with that. If that's what he wants to do, that's fine, right? He goes on and says, my plan at the moment is to withdraw what I need to keep in the 12% tax bracket and then withdraw extra to cover the purchase of capital equipment for the business, which we can write off immediately. So he's starting this new business, and he's going to be able to write off the capital equipment on 179 deduction. And also, Trump's got not only a 179 deduction increase this year, he's also got your fact that you can use accelerated depreciation to write off any buildings that you would buy and all the additions that go with it. So there's massive write-offs available right now. Very good year to pull this money out if he could do something with it business-wise, including if he could pull it out and buy a large piece of real estate with the $560,000. I don't think that's what he's aiming at so far, though. My plan at the moment is to withdraw what I need to keep the 12% bracket and then withdraw extra to cover the purchase of this capital for the business. The business is an S corporation. However, this only works for this year and probably next. The 179 has really been accelerated for this year and next year. But again, all of these decisions are based on avoiding taxation. Okay, moving on. The question is now, can passive real estate protect me from excessive income taxes on my RMDs, required minimum distributions, in the short term? I'm asking you about passive at the moment because in the short term, I'm building another business which keeps me busy. I plan on enrolling in the lifestyles because it seems less risky than stock market in the near term, and I currently pay more than the price of your organization than I pay in quality financial information from multiple sources. Thanks for your advice in advance. So the answer to Brian's question is that no, passive income or that the being a passive investor doesn't give you the ability to write off unlimited amounts of depreciation against all of your other forms of income. Being an active real estate investor does. And so in all intents and purposes, you would think that bringing money out of an IRA you inherited, you didn't work for that money. You get it. You pull it out. You pay the taxes that were never paid on it. But that money is not passive income. That is earned income. Somebody earned that income and didn't pay the income taxes on it. So whoever has that account now has to pay the income taxes on it. So what you're really looking at is, can you take passive losses against earned income? And the reality is, yes, you can. If you make less than $100,000 a year, you can write off up to, believe it or not, $25,000 a year of passive losses against earned income. If you make less than $100,000 a year, but you have to have those passive losses, and you're not going to have those passive losses unless you buy quite a bit of real estate that puts out a lot of depreciation. Now, this year, like this gentleman brought up in his email, is that Trump has created a massive opportunity to take accelerated depreciation options. So if ever there was a time and place that this kind of a theory would work, it's right now, Brian. It's the fact that you can go out there and buy some real estate and crank out some accelerated depreciation right away, the first year. And then you could draw down on that account to the amount that whatever you had. Now, once you're an active real estate investor, there is no limitation to how much you can take. Now, if you make over $150,000 a year, the most you can take is $3,000. But if you make less than $100,000 a year, you can take $25,000. But if you are a real estate professional, if you go out there and buy yourself an apartment complex and you do all the things to record that you are a real estate professional, then in that case, and he may not even still be able to qualify for that since he owns his own business where he works and has time involved. He may not be able to put in enough time with real estate to get it. But as a passive investor, he could at least, if he makes less than $200,000 a year. Now, here's where it gets really tricky about all this. In this explanation that he's giving us, his wife works, so that's income. He's taking money out of the IRA, that's income. And he owns a business, and that's income. So I don't know how you get to have all those forms of income and not be over 12%. I just don't understand it. But that's okay. You know, we're here to answer questions, not to, you know, cast any dispersions. But the next question, the next point I would make is listening to this email, guys. If I were you, this is way too complicated. There's too much going on in this guy's life. There's too many people working. There's too many different businesses, and they don't click together. And he's having fun day trading, and he's having fun starting a new business, and his wife works, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now he's talking about coming here and doing real estate. I doubt that we'll see him here, to be honest with you, Brian. I hope you do make it here someday. But with all that you're doing right now, there's really no room to squeeze something else in there with that lack of time available to you. So, guys, as we go through this, you have to understand that this whole process is a journey. And you're trying to work your way from one spot to another spot in life, right? The one spot in many of your cases is that you have no passive streams of income. And we want to build up some passive streams of income. And some of you have some passive streams of income. You're out there right now. You got a few rent houses. But the way you put it together, you created too much work for yourself. And so you're now burnt out. And then there's also just the overwhelmed problem. You know, I bought a couple properties or I inherited a couple properties from my family. And, you know, I had one bad tenant and it was just overwhelming how much problems, how many and how deep the problems can go from one tenant being bad. And it overwhelms people because they don't know how to deal with it. They haven't set it up correctly. You haven't put the right tenant in from the beginning. You're failing from day one. To the point of just being exhausted. I get that. You know, I've had things in life where I've been exhausted. And what you have to do is you have to just pull your head out of the mess. And I would say come to one of our seminars. Let us talk to you. When you watch the seminar, for 35 years I've had people tell me, Del, I get it now. I see everything I did wrong. If I would have done it your way, I wouldn't have had the problems I had. The problems I had were strictly because I did it incorrectly. And that always sounds great to me, except knowing that, well, I wish you had come to me sooner before you made those mistakes, but it's not the natural way. The natural way in life is when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I'm here, and my program is here, and we can help you. But you got to get off the couch. You got to come in and look in. Some of you have got real estate already. You're not using it and utilizing it the way you should be. You've got equity. You're not utilizing the equity the way you should be. Some of you got lots of money sitting in different 401ks and IRAs or equity in your house that's not being utilized in an effective manner. You could do better things with it. You could diversify what you're doing with it. You could change your financial situation for you and your family's future. But you're going to have to make some changes. So you need to get in here. Right? You need to get in here. Now, by the way, if you'd like to find out about signing up, you can text the word radio to 88007. That's 88007. Text the word radio. And you'll find that there's a free workshop you can take to find out what we do, how we do what we do, what you'll need to bring to it if you're going to do it with us and learn how to do it. So that's radio. Text that word radio to 88007. And there's a discount in there for you. If you're interested. So go ahead and log on and get involved. But get in here. Get started. Learn something. I guarantee you this. You go to that today, you will come out impressed that, wow, I should have taken this years ago. I hear that from every single person that goes through it. Whether or not you want to do what we do or not, you might just go, wow, that was great to know. Now I know what I don't want to do. So remember this, though. It's not just money. This is your lifestyle. Have a great day. See you tomorrow.
Listening to the Del Wamsley Radio Show. Want more of Del's unconventional wisdom? Go to lifestylesunlimited.com and click the radio tab. Listen to past shows, hear podcasts on demand, and find out how you can change your life today. The Del Wamsley Radio Show is part of the Lifestyles Unlimited Radio Network.
The information and opinions you hear on the Del Walmsley Radio Show are those of the host, Del Walmsley, his guests, and his callers, and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of this station, its affiliates, its management, or advertisers. The Del Walmsley Show is for entertainment purposes only. Please consult a professional regarding your personal investment needs. Nothing presented on the Del Walmsley Show constitutes an endorsement, recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or security.